Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Go ham on those eggs.
Away we go. Yeesh.
Hooray. Quiche, did you just say quiche?
No, I said yeesh, but I should say quiche.
That would have been so good if you said quiche.
I'm not that funny.
You will be. I don't know. Right, let's get started. Who's going? It's me. Right. Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theatre Happy Hour. I'm Jimmy.
And I'm Tommy, and this is the only musical theatre podcast with barroom brawls
and orchestra stalls. Here, we take apart your favourite shows, muddle them together with a shot of buffoonery, and pour you a refreshing glass of musical theatre conversation. Hey, Tommy. What are you drinking today?
Variations on a cup of coffee. Sometimes I put the sugar in first and then add the coffee over top. Sometimes it's drip coffee. Sometimes I'd go for tea instead if I'm like, screw coffee.
Absolutely.
And sometimes
Colombian roast Ecuadorian.
Sometimes I just invite Stephen Sondheim over to, you know, grind some coffee beans for me.
I did that the other week, actually. He was such good chat. It was so nice. So good. Excellent. That sounds delicious. I'm confused, Tommy. Enlighten me.
I will.
Enlighten.
Via a quiz question in our archaic and difficult manner in which we disclose the title of the musical.
Right. Seamless.
The, quote, definitive version of this infinitely revised operetta premiered in Glasgow in 1988. It has since been revised multiple times. What show could it possibly be, Jimmy?
It is Candide.
Who knows?
Yes. Hey, Glasgow. Thank you for saying Glasgow and not Glasgow.
It's entirely by accident every time I do it right.
It is. It's the eternal Moscow, Moscow, Glasgow, Glasgow. It's not a Glasgow. It is a Glasgow. Candide.
Where do you start?
Literally. So intimidated. So intimidated by this. It's taken us 3 months.
So many people have written entire, like, you know, 100-page dissertations about this show.
Yeah, exactly.
And here we are saying that we're even going to be able to scratch the surface.
Absolutely. I think I want to say just off the bat, we want to give a shout out to Mr. Colden Lamb.
Oh, thank you.
Who basically wrote a PhD in our email inbox about Candide.
Yes.
It was very helpful certainly pointing us.
He gave us a meta-analysis, which is something I've learned about in the medical world, where you like gather up the 100 papers about a thing and do an analysis on the papers.
Yeah, it's like a lit review.
It's like a lit review. That's probably
he did a lit review in Candide for us, which was lovely. It was very comprehensive. We're very, very grateful for that. Sorry it's taken us 3 months, but there was a lot to get through, to be honest.
That's true.
A 100-page essay. So You know, we do the work, guys.
The book itself is so long. It took me so long to get through.
I know, literally. There's like, what, 20 words? I feel like the list of songs that are in the musical is actually slightly longer than the original novella. So.
Isn't that, well, we'll get to it. But that's how they introduced the 2001 Lincoln Center. The narrator says, like, Voltaire's Candide is a short little pamphlet where there's absolutely no singing. Bernstein's Candide is a long operetta where everyone practically insists upon it.
Yes, that is a beautiful, beautiful way of putting it. Okay, less beating around the bush. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Where did it all begin?
Candide premiered on Broadway in 1956. It had pretty bad reviews, only played for 73 performances. That version was by Leonard Bernstein and Lillian Hellman and Richard Wilbur. Mostly. All said and done, the show has music by Leonard Bernstein, lyrics by Richard Wilbur, John Latouche, Dorothy Parker, Lillian Hellman, Stephen Sondheim, and Leonard Bernstein, and then has a book by Lillian Hellman and or Hugh Wheeler, depending upon how you cut it.
I mean, so this, there are so many versions of this. We can't just be like, this was the Broadway opening and then this was the revival and there you go. Like we said, the original Hellman version now no longer exists.
Yeah. Lost to time.
Yeah, the next kind of notable one, which is actually a good place to start if you're completely new to Candide, is called the Chelsea version from 1973, and it has a red cover on Spotify. And it's quite good because it gives you the book in between the songs,
yes,
to help you kind of make sense of what the hell is going on.
And that's the one with the new book by Hugh Wheeler.
Yes, indeedo. And then... we had what's called the Opera House version, which was directed by Hal Prince as well, which features some more songs, because why not? There weren't enough.
An opera company. Then we move on to what is called, per our quiz question, the definitive version in 1988. It's the reason it exists is because Lillian Hellman died and the parts of her script that she didn't want back in the show could be put back in the show.
Exactly. I think Leonard Bernstein was really inspired by it. It was a Scottish opera production. He was really inspired by that. And he was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to write the final version. And then we had another one.
And then we revised it again. There's a revised Opera House version that came out in 94 that adds the Sondheim and Latouche lyrics. That version was built upon for a 1997 Broadway version. Then it was revised again for the Royal National Theatre in 99. And then it starts to fall apart.
Exactly.
You know,
and then you can expect that we're saying the Jim and Tomic version,
right?
Which will be launching shortly after this podcast is released.
Exactly.
It's exclusively on Zoom, and it will be really good. I think really groundbreaking.
I think it's really, and it is very representative of the time we're in today.
Well, I mean, there are things to be said there that I'm sure we will say.
I said that jokingly, but...
Yeah, exactly. So, can you give us a brief summary about what happens?
Oh, man.
How brief can you be?
Candide lives in a fictional Austrian town, Westphalia. A bastard son taken in by a royal family under the tutelage of Dr. Pangloss, whose thesis is that everything is for the best in this best of all possible worlds. Candide is the optimist. Things must be for the best. And then, of course, is beset upon by untold horrors. The town is pillaged. Pangloss is beset upon by the plague. Cunegonde, his not quite betrothed, raped repeatedly across the course of the show. All very tongue in cheek. Everyone dies about six times throughout the course of the show. And it is based on Voltaire's novel, a discussion of is a satire of. Mm-hmm. Unwavering optimism, saying that, you know, it is such a ridiculous thing to believe that everything happens for a reason, and then exploring some of the philosophical implications of that in song.
Yeah, and it's deeply rooted in philosophy.
Yeah.
And again, more on that story later. But should we dive on in into the world of candy?
Of how did we get here?
Exactly.
His life is absolute perfection, as is true of my complexion. Every time I look and see me, I'm reminded life is dreamy. Although I do get tired being endlessly admired. People will go on about me, how could they go on without me? That's not the kind of business. Why should they be so delicious? It is a heavy duty to protect my awesome beauty. I have almost no objection. I am everything I need. Life is happiness, indeed.
I mean, it's so strange because I'm like, where do we actually begin?
Right. Well, because this show, this show is 54 years old, and has had maybe as many revisions across the course of history.
As years.
Right. You know, this is a show that everyone agrees could be good and agrees hasn't been good when they've seen it.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful way of putting it. I feel like all discussions about it, whether it's an essay, whether it's a full-length thesis,
yeah,
that's the kind of crux of it.
It's always a discussion of like what Candide could be.
Yeah, it's always like, it was almost there, but... and I find that utterly fascinating, yeah, because what's stopping it?
Right. Well, and you go back to... So the explicit history, you know, in 1956 it premiered... The Hellman and Bernstein version. Bernstein started working on it before West Side Story, or this is right around that time. It's hard to unpack, but Lillian Hellman was blamed for the poor reception of the initial production. Her book seems to be what most people had the problem with.
Yes.
And so then it becomes a question of, you know, how do you, you know, I was trying to think about this. Are there other shows where a book writer has been so publicly cut, where like the full production has existed and then basically post the premiere, the book writer is fired and then they bring on a new book writer? I can think of plenty of examples where that happens before the show premieres, but to have this like post premiere revision be the groundwork for this show, I think has done a lot of things to set it up for what it has become today.
Absolutely. Because it just shows you that there wasn't that cohesion right at the start between Bernstein and Wheeler. Hellman. God, it's gonna happen a lot. Between Bernstein and Hellman. And that when you have that rocky foundation, you're never going to be able to produce something solid. And I think a lot of people say that it seems like they were writing in that original production, they were just writing two different shows.
Yeah.
But Bernstein was the one that people cared about.
Yeah.
So his kind of was we're not obviously going to change the music.
Right.
So what are you going to do about your book?
Well, I do. I do wonder about that in a more like in a broader musical theater context, because I can't imagine it going the other way. You know, no show has ever persisted because of its book. Even shows with the best book, right? You know, book writers are notoriously undervalued. Not saying that Hellman's version is great, like by all remarks, you know, the critics aren't wrong. But of course the music is what people want to keep, because musicals are built around music.
Completely.
You know.
And it was Bernstein's idea,
right?
At the end of the day, so it really does make sense that it would be his thing. But I think it shows you that you can't have one without the other,
right? Yeah, and I do think a lot of then, you know, because this hole just keeps getting dug deeper and deeper. Like the Candide we have now is a result of that initial willingness to, you know, hack and slash at this thing. Which already, like, I've had this thought before about, like, divergent and convergent art making. You know, whether it is people coming together to create a collaborative piece, or, as often happens in musical theater, people diverging away from each other. And, like, you can draw, you know, almost like a genetic tree of the show, of the different parts that have been woven in and out, and rearranged. And so then, like, immediately after the Hellman version, or maybe not immediately, but a couple decades later, Hal Prince got the bright idea to redo this thing, brought on Hugh Wheeler, and the Chelsea version was created mostly without Bernstein's input.
Yeah.
Which is also pretty wild. Had a, you know, cool staging by the sounds of it, was, you know, very, very hippie. It is the sense I get from reading descriptions.
Yeah, it seems very Hal Princey.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Very, like, of its time, shall we say?
That sounds about right. And they cut the thing down. It was like 100 minutes long. And apparently it was very successful, but it had a brand new book. Mm-hmm. And so then already you've got this book that's, you know, one, trying to fix the problems of the past, but also, and you have the new book because Lillian Hellman, you know, explicitly said, don't you dare use my book.
Right.
If you're going to change this thing.
Which I also, I find that quite funny.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, your work won't exist.
Right.
So, and I appreciate it. Like, I do, like, I think if I wrote something and someone was like, we don't like it, we're going to change it.
Mm-hmm.
I would obviously take that really personally, but it depends how invested you are, because could you, like, how, I guess, how proud do you need to be to say, no, mine is definitive.
Right.
Like, mine is perfect here.
Yeah.
There's no need to change it. When everyone is telling you, it's not working.
Right.
So how are we going to make this? And I think you'd be like, okay, well, let's try. I feel like at least you would try.
And it begs the question, you know, you said without this, like, your work doesn't exist. Like, it begs the question of what is the work, right?
Mm.
Because the book isn't, is the book the text on the page? Is the book the ideas? Is the book those thoughts being performed in the context of the musical?
Yeah.
You know?
Because I think, like, I think for... for Hellman specifically, that she really, really wanted to bring the novella onto the stage and keep that same quite cynical ideal. And I think it's really telling that Hal Prince moved right away from that and wanted to make it more theatrical and more satirical, but on the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
Not as acerbic, much more... slapstick.
Right, exactly. So, you know, these are unbelievable characters and you're watching them. And it's interesting because I would say recent revisions, like the 2009-2010 Mary Zimmerman production reincorporated a bunch of, like, direct adaptations from the novella. And so almost as if we're swinging back towards that, you know, cynicalism. It is this pendulum of art that we, you know, so often happen upon across decades.
Absolutely. But what I find quite interesting, and this is a sort of nerdy tangent, but we've talked about it before with things like The Fantastics and other shows set around late 60s, early 70s, about how they were really trying to push the boundaries in terms of art and in terms of just testing what an audience is capable of watching.
Yeah.
And I find it really interesting that... Hal Prince went down the more accessible route as opposed to the, okay, well, let's challenge you a bit here.
Right.
But then I wonder if that's just because Candide already isn't hugely accessible.
Right, it's so all over the place.
To kind of get the kids into the house, you need to try and be like, hey,
right,
want to try something?
Yeah, you need big arrows and like, over here, you get it? Like,
for sure. So yeah, after... this version.
1973, the Chelsea version.
Yep. We then had a few others, and then the kind of next notable one was the Opera House version, which was moving back into the operetta ideal of Candide and away from the musical theater.
Yeah. And this is where Bernstein kind of comes back into the picture more so, I would say.
Yeah.
you know, he brings in some of the songs he had written that were, you know, either cut from the Chelsea version or weren't even included in the Hellman version. You know, and this starts to become, if you've seen Candide at all and are listening to this, you've probably seen something most based on this opera house version, I would say.
Uh-huh. In terms of like order.
Yeah.
and content.
Structure, existence, who knows?
It's so funny, we'd be like, yeah, this content is most similar to what you might know. That's just nonsense.
It's so
how can you say that about anything?
Right, but like that's the thing. No one has seen the Hellman version. No one who's listening to this, likely, has seen... If you are, thank you for being alive to see the Hellman version and also
exactly.
being capable of listening to a podcast. I appreciate you deeply.
Yeah,
and I mean that, non-ironically. but like, the you know, it is... We talk about this in fits and starts with other shows where you see these, you know, where we like break apart the minor differences between this revival of a Sondheim show and that revival of a Sondheim
right.
show. And Candide is like, wait, hold my beer. You know,
exactly.
we're going
to... I've got my sledgehammer, so...
Yeah, exactly. Control A, delete, like...
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happened. And then it happened again.
Yeah.
And it happened again.
I think the sense I get is sometime in 1982, this started to become a pet project of Bernstein again.
Yeah, I think he was probably just like, oh, look, people care about this.
Right.
This is still existing. You know what I mean? This is still my world. And probably, you know, the popularity of West Side Story might have been dying out a little bit. And he was like, hang on.
Well, also by then it starts to stand on its own as, or like the separate pieces start to stand on their own. Like the overture is, you know, getting a whole bunch of traction being performed
it's
by,
iconic. Yeah.
you know, Philharmonic orchestras and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so if you, like, if To Be or Not To Be is the popular monologue from Hamlet, it's worth it to keep the whole piece going as well so that
for
people
sure.
know the context for the thing.
For sure. And so that's how we ended up with the... definitive
yes
version definitive. I posit that to you, Thomas.
It's a wild I mean, you know, the art is never done, only abandoned. I mean I think it takes a Bernsteinian amount of hubris to describe a piece of art as a definitive version.
Definitive, yeah. Now is it only called that because he died shortly after?
I think it's called that because he said it was going to be the definitive version.
Right, okay.
Like that, you know, that's what it takes. And that's
yeah.
that's the problem and the delight with art is like you only have control over it until you're gone. And if it's good enough, people are going to keep trying to improve upon it beyond your death.
Yeah.
You know, I think
I guess that's one of the interesting things about theater is that's a thing you can do,
right? And it's
art that can still change after you've gone.
And it's much more common, and I think much more. I'm going to get this wrong because I, you know, failed out of my English minor. I believe F. Scott Fitzgerald was like notoriously resistant to any of his books being adapted into anything, television, plays, movies, or whatever.
Right.
And then, of course, shortly after his death. They started churning the wheels to create the Great
yeah.
Gatsby movie.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and that's, if you know that, and assuming I'm remembering that correctly, it seems much dirtier. Whereas current revisions of Candide are celebrated in the theatrical community. You know, people are like,
absolutely.
Oh, you know, if only he could see this, if only he's around to see what people have done with his work. And like, who knows? He might be rolling over in his grave.
Potentially. Maybe he had the same kind of Hellman vibe of like, no, this is my thing.
Right.
I don't want anyone else touching it. Only I can. Who knows?
I do certainly think post the definitive version is why people have stopped calling them revisions.
Yeah, fair.
You know?
Because it's kind of, there's no new music. I guess it comes back to that point of like, is it the book, is it the music, is it a combo?
Right.
I think for Candide, it is the music because we're not going to get any new songs
yeah.
for Candide.
Well, it's...
We may yet get a new book.
In you know, even in researching this, and anyone who's, you know, done this sort of stuff, you'll sympathize, but, like, you type in Candide, you get the novella. The only way you get what you're looking for is to type in Leonard Bernstein's Candide into
yep.
Google. You know, you don't type in Candide musical because that's already fraught, you know, and exactly. No one else's name is so strongly associated with this thing more than Bernstein's.
Completely. So yeah, I think it's really telling that it's him who stood the test of time.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, maybe even down the line, if we'll get a book that is equally as definitive. Do you know what I mean? Where someone would be right. like, wow, this works.
Well,
this marries well with this music.
When you look at the Wheeler version, which you know was directly adapted to try and puzzle piece into the missing pieces from Hellman's book, like one of the craziest things to me is that they had to reinvent new names for the locations because those were all basically Hellman's intellectual property. That's wild and stupid. Like,
totally.
You know, they're all made up places for the most part. Like,
yep.
You know, or close enough. So to be able to craft a book, like this is that, you know, divergent and convergent writing thing. Like any book that would do these songs well has to be a good enough puzzle piece fit to the things that the songs are asking for. But because the original book was already kind of, you know, cited as not even fitting into those pieces, it's like, you know, it's like there's the receptacle is broken. There's not a great receiver for a good book because the songs are beautiful and lack a through line.
Exactly.
You know?
And I think that's really crucial.
Yeah. Like there's not a good hook for a book writer left anymore.
Not at all. I mean, it's funny because there are so many songs. Like it is kind of like looking at the pot of crayons and being like, wow, I could really make anything here.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk about the music?
Yeah, let's talk about the music. So which crayon do you want?
Oh man, there's a great
there's over 100.
Yeah, we'll link the definitive Candide write-up. It's on Sondheim Guide, of course. Thank you, Sondheim Guide. And by our count, there are 101 songs that at one point were considered to be in this thing. Now, some of them were like, in this one biography, someone said that the original music written for Dear Officer Krupke was actually intended to be in Candide, and imagine what that would have been. And like, that's, you know,
right.
Not really a cut song per se.
No.
You're not going to adapt G. Officer Krupke back into Candide.
No, but they should, but it probably will happen at some point.
I know, now that we've said it.
Exactly. But yeah, there's... This doesn't happen. This has never happened.
Right.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
This is absolute nonsense. I remember when we did The Music Man, and we found out that Meredith Wilson wrote over 40 songs for The Music Man.
Yeah.
I was like mind blown. I was like, that is amazing. Look at all this content. Like, wow, what a story you could tell.
Right.
I look at this over 100. I'm like, that's just nonsense.
It's just nuts. When I started watching a bunch of different versions of this and like I you know saw it in Chicago twice, we did it in college and particularly I had the conflict over Easily Assimilated and I think it was when I was watching it and I was like, I swear this was like the act one closer. this, it was great. It was like, we're gonna go off. It's a great rousing dance number. Da, 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 yep. Right? But then I yep. was watching the, you know, 2004 Lincoln Center one, and it's this weird quartet of like, set sail. And I'm like, yep. this is not as interesting as easily assimilated. I thought this, and it just doesn't matter. You put the songs really wherever you want.
Exactly. Well, I think We Are Women is really testament to that as well. Yeah. They're used in completely different places for different productions. I think in the definitive, the Scottish opera version, they're put at like quite near the end.
Mm-hmm.
I now can't remember the context for them. Can you?
Patti LuPone and Kristen Chenoweth come out on stage and sing to each other. Like, what is the yes. what is the greater context you need?
I'm just trying to think where they are at that point.
Yeah.
I think they might be in Montevideo.
Yeah.
They're rich at that point anyway. Yeah. I remember that much.
Yeah.
But then previously it's been used when Cunegonde wanted to marry the Archduke.
Yeah.
Or whatever he was. And just even that of like, let's just tear apart the context.
Right.
It really doesn't matter.
Yeah. It does. It does feel like there's plenty of room for flexibility somewhere in the intro. Do you have a narrator? Is it Voltaire? Does Pangloss come out? Whatever. Right.
Yep.
Then you do the introduction set in stone, still with revisions to the lyrics, but yes. best of all possible worlds. And Candide's sad song,
yep,
which is also wild. In the 2004 Lincoln Center version, he like packs his paddle ball away in a suitcase. In the Mary Zimmerman version, in Chicago, there's this huge drop of like this wonderful palace that he lives in, and like his world falls apart, and the drop falls on him, and like the lights go blue, and he uses the thing as a blanket to be like, you know, my world is dust now, and it is so sad. And I'm like, it's the same fucking song, like,
exactly. It is. It's mad. It's really, really mad.
But like, you have that, then you have, you know, Into Auto da Fe and Glitter and Begay, and then you can just do whatever you want all the way until Make Our Garden Grow.
Genuinely. It's really funny. I just like, but to me, right, I'm a bit like, is that a good thing?
Right.
Or is that a bad thing? Like, and I guess separating into good and bad is really stupid and
sure.
asinine. But like, to me, something that you can do that, you can have that much flexibility with,
right,
means that there really can't be any substance.
Right. Yes. Well, and I think that's cart and horse. There is no substance, so you can do that with it.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Like, these characters' motivations are so poorly defined. The plot itself is lampshaded at the beginning of every scene. Oh, I thought you were dead. Well, I was. We'll explain it later. Like,
yeah.
That joke is leaned into so heavily, like, because it doesn't matter.
It's the only way that you can do it.
Right. You know, and we're bouncing back and forth to different places, but the place you're in doesn't really matter unless you have, like, a vast understanding of, you know.
Yeah. Like, generally, the only thing that seems to really matter is that certain characters are on stage. But even then.
Even then, right. It doesn't.
It doesn't.
When I was rewatching for like last night, I was watching with my boyfriend, and you know, you can kind of track like, all right, we've got basically five main characters, and across them, five main voice parts, and so we just want to do the different permutations of those voice parts singing with each other in interesting ways, and you know, who cares what order they happen in.
Genuinely. And then there's kind of a song for every eventuality. So it's like, oh, do you not want to go there next? Okay, well, we've got a song that will take you there.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, it's really...
This is... Ooh.
It's nuts.
I found our adaptation. I found it.
Mm-hmm.
Candide, Mystery of Edwin Drood style.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Do an audience poll.
In the
what
middle,
do you want to hear next?
In the middle of Auto da Fe, you decide on the order of the show.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah. Everyone comes around. You're given a list of literally 100 songs that you have to pick from.
It takes
5 hours.
No. One audience member must come on stage. And there's big cards with the different songs, and they put them in an order, and that's what we're stuck with.
And then that's what you do. It's funny, though, because, like, obviously, I'm sure you've seen, like, improvised musical theatre.
Yeah.
Right? Kind of based on that premise, almost.
Yeah.
It's not, like, it feels like that. And that's the thing that I really struggle with, because I'm like, how can I grow attached to these songs if they have no context?
But so here's
because then they're just songs.
But
where's the musical theater?
Here's the problem. I do, right? Like, you know, we shit talk this, but by the if at the end, like, I bawled at the end of the Mary Zimmerman production, like, so deeply moved. You know, more than I had been for a long time at some, you know, live theatrical pieces. It's awesome. It's very, you know, if you've seen any of Mary Zimmerman's work or know, like, Arabian Nights or something like that, it's very storyteller centric. You know, the narrator idea is divided amongst the cast. The set is this very cool, like, forced perspective, wood clad room with, like, panels that open up in and out.
Yeah.
You know, very simple staging, but very effective.
I think it's really beautiful, actually, her production.
Yeah. And, like, at the very end, during Make Our Garden Grow, the whole set starts to sprout flowers from every direction, just, you know, simply and slowly. The whole thing is gorgeous. And so something had to get me there.
Yeah, but is that, like, who's doing the work?
True. That is the question of the night.
this is what I thought when I was watching it. I was like, so the one that I've watched is the definitive version. And listen, I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
I didn't enjoy it. I've listened to Candide a lot before, and I really like some of the songs. But again, it's that thing of the first time you listen to a cast recording, they're just songs. You're not getting the story.
Right.
And Candide always feels like that to me.
Yeah.
I find it really hard to pinpoint, you know, oh yeah, that one, that's then, because there isn't a then.
Right.
And so with you at the Mary Zimmerman production, what's happened is someone's kind of interpreted and thrown things into a pot in your brain because of whether it's aesthetics or whether it's acting or whether it's, like, you know, whatever.
Right.
Your brain has put them together and told your own story.
Right.
And I think that is where I kind of take issue, I guess.
Yeah. No, that's fair. You know, we said it already, like, Hal Prince, you know, was like, we need big arrows to walk people through this story. And it's true, you know, and I think it's why Candide has this weird relationship with musical theater and opera, because that is the push and pull between musical theater and opera. Opera, the audience does the work. Musical theater, the cast does the work.
Exactly. And I think that's kind of where it comes down to.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, it frustrates me, I guess, because I'm a musical theater boy.
Sure.
And I'm story first,
yeah.
Everything else second.
Yeah.
And when you don't really have a story, it's really tricky.
Let's talk about that, Jimmy, because this is like one of the crazy things about this show is full-fledged, you know, opera groups have done it, and Hal Prince has directed 16 versions of it. Like,
whether it be opera, musical, operetta, musichetta, whatever that
is. Yeah, you know, in concert. Like, so let's talk about, you know, how adaptable and, like, the thousands of different versions of this thing that have been created.
I agree.
So you were dead, you know, you were shot and bayoneted too.
That is very true. Oh, but love will find a way.
Then what did you do?
We'll go into that another day. Now let's talk of you.
Okay. What is it?
The show?
Yeah.
No one can agree.
No one can agree.
I used to, it's been a long time, but I used to be pretty involved in Wicked Project Musical Theater, which is now very much defunct.
I remember when you told me this for the first time, by the way, I was like, I felt like I was in the presence of like greatness. It was nothing to do with your whatever how many thousand subscribers on YouTube. I was like, this guy has like changed my life with how much wiki he's
written. Was long before Musical Theater MASH even, but there are still large sections of synopsi and other portions of musical theater articles on Wikipedia that like I wrote.
We have so much to be grateful for you.
I do what I can.
Thank you.
But
thank
I distinctly, Wikipedia editors are notorious about turf. You know, who's in charge of what article. And I remember getting in a minor beef with Wicked Project Opera over Candide, over whose style guide was going to apply to the thing. And at the time, exactly. I didn't know much about Candide, so I was like, fine, whatever, you guys tackle it. And now as a grown-ass adult, my thought is like, who cares? It's all, you know, we're going to, you know, give away the same information.
Right,
But it is, this is one of those shows that it begs the question, does the content create the medium, or does the medium define the content? Are operas that way because they're written to be operas? Or is the piece performed that way because it's in an opera house?
Yeah. So this I feel like is the ultimate question. Like, this is the, you know, that really horrible plot line in Doctor Who. Where it was like the
ultimate
the
question,
spoken,
the last
the word
question
will be spoken at the end of the question, or whatever the stupid phrase
is. Doctor Who. Yes, I do remember that
nonsense. I feel like this is hours of that.
Yeah,
because so many people have asked me this, and I like stumble through an answer and just throw loads of words at them, and I think they leave kind of satisfied, but I have no idea what I just said because it's so. There's just this eternal push-pull. Like, if you try and map out... I can't remember when... We have talked about opera before, because we've talked about Wagner before.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about it with
Sweeney
when. Way back when?
Well, that is way back when. We're talking 4 years there, T.
Yeah.
Maybe we talked about it in Throppney Opera as well. That was written as a response to the Wagnerian operas.
Yeah.
But, like... If you look at the journey and then, you know, throw G&S in the mix there as well.
Right.
There's just so much crossover and overlap.
Yeah.
That one changes into the other without anyone kind of realizing what's happened.
Right.
And obviously since then, we've had operas that look more like musicals and we've had musicals that look like...
I think nowadays, in maybe even in the 2010s, I don't even know if we were quite there when I was in college. But like nowadays, I think we've all come around to a postmodern understanding of performance art that like all of this is the same and all of this is different and you can call upon bits and pieces of whatever in whatever and that's fine.
Well, what I would say is I'm going to get shot, but what I would say is I think musical theatre people, well, not all musical theatre people, I think a handful of musical theatre people would agree with that.
Yeah.
And probably a handful of opera people would agree with that, but I think a lot of opera people would be like, no.
That's fair.
Opera is opera.
Yeah.
Because there's something about, I guess because it's so long-standing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, opera has etched, that's not the word, etched.
Yes.
Its word... It's mark into the stone of history.
And
you know
there's a piece of pride that comes with going to the opera or going to a concert or going to the ballet. Like, yes, I am an intellectual and I understand and you know I have the mental
Absolutely.
Facilities, right? And I don't. I say that in a teasing voice.
It's
true.
It's true. It's absolutely true. That's why kind of the birth of musical theater was created. That's why. But, you know, Brecht wrote Throppney Opera was because he was like, I need to give stuff that people can actually watch, that people, like, the punters can go to.
Right.
As opposed to the hoi polloi.
I also think if a contemporary, you know, opera feel went to a, you know, 1800s opera, they'd be bored out of their mind.
Oh, I really agree.
Right?
Because, like, I think, like, see if we look at some other contenders for this, you know, the people who live on the divide. Jerry Springer.
Mm-hmm.
Very much a musical.
Right.
As in terms of like what people call it.
Right.
But just, it's really just a modern opera.
Yeah.
It resembles so many other modern operas.
Right. Well, and
what is it that's made that?
I mean, and this is, you know, we're two tangents in, but that's the whole plot of Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. Like that.
What did you just say?
Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. Have you heard about this?
I have not heard about this. What's that?
What? Oh, you would love it.
Mr. Burns, as in The Simpsons?
Yes. I don't know if this will make the cut. I'm amazed we've never talked about this. You will love
it.
You will love this play, Jimmy. You should read it because you can't see it anywhere. It's three acts. The first act starts after the apocalypse. Whatever it is, doesn't matter. It has happened recently. And the remnants of humanity or whoever is gathered around the campfire. And they're like, oh, do you remember that episode of The Simpsons? And they're like, oh, yeah, that one. And then Mr. Burns is like, blah, 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 you know. And they're basically, and they basically retell the plot of one episode of The Simpsons best they can around the campfire. Because humanity is gone, right? It doesn't exist
so
anymore.
It's kind of talking about storytelling.
It
and
only exists in their
on.
Brain. Act two, humanity is starting to rebuild, and a troupe of traveling players performs this episode of The Simpsons in, like, you know, trash bags and on abandoned cars and, like, you know, to the best they can. And some pieces get lost in the middle, and some pieces of remembered culture start to come back into the thing. Things that aren't related to The Simpsons, but that we remember as part of our culture. Act three, humanity has entirely rebuilt, and there's now this opera that is this episode of The Simpsons, but also has, like, Britney Spears songs in it. And, like, you know, like a very stylized Homer mask and a Marge headpiece, and, like, it is so clever.
Oh my God,
and
I love
so
that.
Funny.
You repeat the title to me.
Mr. Burns, a post-electric play.
Post-electric.
I think that's what it's called.
That's amazing.
Yeah, you would love it. You should look up some photos of it.
What an amazing idea.
Yeah.
I really, really, I'm totally into that.
Yeah, I'm amazed we've never talked about it because you absolutely would love it.
But that's, you know what? It sits in an interesting place because it that idea of heightening and, you know, what is the kind of story that you're telling and what does everything look like? It's just it's impossible to answer because the other one, it was interesting what you said earlier about is it the content, is it the house?
Yeah.
Because I saw the ENO version, English National Opera version of Sweeney.
Interesting.
With Bryn Terfel, who's an opera singer.
Yeah.
And Emma Thompson, who is not.
Right.
So it was in the Colosseum, which is a massive, very important, significant opera house. And obviously ENO did it because they wanted to be kind of like expanding their repertoire and realizing that we want to make sure that opera stays and grows.
They did it because they needed a cellar that month.
A cellar, well, exactly. When I watched it, I couldn't tell what it was.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it was weird. The way that they started it, I think I might have spoken about this before, but the way they started it was very traditional. They had the plants at either side of the stage. There was a grand piano on the stage, and everyone was in formal dress, and they came out with their scores as if it was going to be like a concert performance.
Yeah.
And then halfway through the overture, they all start shutting their books and throwing them around. And then at one point, they pick up the grand piano and throw it.
I've seen that, yeah.
Right, and it was really effective. It was really, really effective because it was very much like, this isn't your average opera.
Right, right. But see, then we're subverting the style, but are we? Like,
exactly, because also it kind of had nothing to do with Sweeney Todd.
Well, I do, I guess the third question of like, is it the content, is it the house? If you flip that, like if it's the content, I would say the content of Sweeney Todd feels more operatic to me than the content of Candide.
Yeah.
Candide has
because
bits...
it's inbuilt into it.
Right.
This idea of the kind of Greek chorus, the backing singers, well, and the main players.
And so, Sweeney Todd is important. You know, attend to the tale. It's about murder. Candide is like, oh, raped again. Like,
yeah.
You know, nothing is important in Candide.
Yeah, that's a good point actually, because the kind of alienating effect that Sweeney Todd has is really intrinsic and always taken quite seriously,
right.
Whereas the alienating effect in Candide is on the more frivolous side of things. So like what Brecht would have done in his comedies as opposed to his like serious moral plays.
But you get to decide, because there are different versions of this show. There are ones where Voltaire or a narrator comes out and goes, "The story of Candide." And there are ones where that doesn't happen.
Yep. And there are ones where it's literally set in America.
Oh, God.
With American history characters.
Yeah. I'm going to butcher the name, the Chateau de Bleu.
The Theatre Châtelet.
That's what I said. The French version. There's a couple clips you can see of this thing that we'll put in the links and you should watch, but maybe watch in private. It's a send up of McCarthyism, and a bunch of other American things.
It's just like kind of American political history.
There, during auto de fe, there's a whole chorus of Ku Klux Klan members that come out and start dancing around a bunch of business people.
There are indeed.
Yeah, like it is. And the finale, Make Our Garden Grow, is the whole set is this huge television, and they drop a projection screen. And as they sing Make Our Garden Grow, projected on the screen are all these scenes of like, you know, desolate forests and garbage heaps and like, you know, fallout from bombings and fires and like about how we're destroying the earth, juxtaposed with like, make our garden grow. Like,
exactly.
It's moving. It's something for sure.
It's certainly stirring.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. You get it quite a lot where it's like, are you doing that for shock value? What is the story that you're telling with
right.
this?
I saw a clip of I think it's a Berlin version. The whole page was in German, so I couldn't understand a lot of it.
Yeah,
but the
Berlin.
clip was Glitter and Be Gay. And Cunegonde is like standing on a bar with a stripper pole. That's how she sings a song, which is story appropriate. That is what she's doing, but it felt it's so different than, you know, her in a bathtub, or, you know, her dancing around a lounge with pearls, like in a pink tutu, you know, wildly different interpretations of the same piece. So I get like your initial question. Someone comes up to you and says, is Candide an opera or a musical? And I think the answer is like, well, it depends on what you do with it.
Kind of, but then it's weird because I think with Candide, I would say there are lots more opera versions than there are musical theater versions.
That's
in
fair.
Fact, I find it really difficult to pick out the ones where I'm like, I identify this as a musical theater. I'd say the biggest one would be the Daniel Evans version, which I think is the 1999.
Okay.
It's a British one.
Okay.
It's the one on Spotify that has like the moon or something on it.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. There's like a yellow. Is it like a man with a yellow back and is blue and yellow and?
Oh, potentially. I don't know. This is Daniel Evans one. I think
riveting.
It's
riveting podcast material.
Yeah, it kind of looks like that. We're just letting you have the opportunity to look for yourself, listeners. Anyway, it's really low key. Mm-hmm. The orchestrations are V small.
Yeah.
It's sung in a musical theater style.
Okay.
And it's not very good. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, I'm like, is that telling?
Right. Yeah.
Is that the thing? Is like when you try and musical theaterize this, and I've read a couple of reviews and things, and apparently it is a lot more low key, and they are really hitting into the storytelling aspect of it and the musical theater of it, as opposed to listen to this music and perhaps feel something.
Right.
I'm so sorry, people who like opera.
Well, there are better operas.
Yeah.
No one
fair.
Has. No, I will say, even the biggest opera pedants, I would be struck if someone who says Candide is the best opera, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Or the pinnacle of what opera should be.
Yeah. That's a good. But probably because it's bastardized, because it's this, it treads this line.
Right.
But then Sweeney Todd isn't. I don't know. I'm
yeah,
just so,
it's,
I'm
we
so
don't
confused.
Have the, you know, the world of performed musical theater, in performed music performance encompassing opera, I will say, is such a small sample size. Like, this is a problem we encounter all the time, that trying to draw patterns between these things is often fruitless, because Candide is the only Candide, right? It's not like Candide is representative of 16, well, maybe it is the 16 other Candides.
I know.
But, like, the vast chasm between Candide and Sweeney Todd is huge, and they're still so very close to each other because Stephen Sondheim studied under Leonard Bernstein. Like, there's only a couple people who make these things.
Yeah.
And so whenever you start
sorry, I just had like a little epiphany there, because like, an argument that I often get into with Light in the Piazza is that it's too much like an operetta.
Yeah.
And obviously, Sondi was a big mentor to Adam Gettle.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's just dripping down.
And it's
that's an interesting point.
Like, we talk about musical theater like it is this huge genre, and it is, but compared to other things, like there's no comparing. You know, walk through the fiction section in the library. Walk through the mystery section of the fiction section in the library. You know, walk through the vampire romance mystery section in the library, and you will find a more diverse group of books than the whole canon of musical theater, right?
Yeah.
And so once you start to, you know, it's why this is fun. It's why it's fun to unpack these things and draw the parallels,
totally.
Because there are so few, and we can keep them all in our head. You know, whereas, like, I try not to keep Twilight in my head.
I think you find it difficult, just because, like, musical theater wouldn't exist without opera.
For sure.
Do you know what I mean? And it feels like just a little clade of it. But because it's got such deep popularity, because it's so bloody good, I think that's why it's tricky. And that's why we find it really, I don't know, really difficult.
Is Great Comet an opera?
No.
Why?
I don't know. Because it doesn't feel... Because I like it.
Because
it doesn't feel like
that's
it.
That's the problem.
Because you can understand what they're saying.
And that's
I don't know. Like,
and it's an unfair question, because I will say Great Comet was conceived in the, you know, a postmodern acceptance of...
Exactly. Because, like, people would
genre
say
bending.
It's Great Comet musical theater.
Right.
You know what I mean? Is it transcendent?
Right.
Yes, of course it is, because it's the best.
Right.
But, yeah, if there's someone who is kind of taking it to the next... thing, it's probably someone like Dave Malloy, who's
right.
like, well, listen, let's look at this.
Right.
Let's look at this theme.
But it's still drawing upon the, you know, the trickle down of both musical theater and opera.
For sure.
And a thousand other things, as all of these, you know, pieces
are.
And
the thing is, Tommy, I would argue that it's still too early to look for the next thing.
Yeah.
Because opera was around for hundreds of years before, you know, Oscar Hammerstein and Richard Rodgers were like,
right,
let's see what we can do.
Musical theater, we're just about to crack a century.
Really just.
Yeah.
And I think in that case, it probably is too early to be like, okay, we've got this. You know what I mean? We know what this is now.
Yeah.
What's next?
Yeah.
Because I think anything that attempts to go next will always just fall back to being, okay, well, yeah, it's just a nice, interesting piece of musical theater,
right?
You know,
well, you're just, you know, you're expanding the circle of the Venn diagram until your little bloop has gotten so big that it's so far away from the center that, like, you know, you mitosis into another category.
Exactly. Love this biology of blades. Mitosis is great. How is your bloop, by the way? I was meant to ask you.
My bloop?
Yeah, your little bloop.
My bloop.
Well, you just said it.
Bloop?
And it sounded really funny. It sounded like a... Yeah, you said that. You said those words not 4 seconds
ago.
Oh,
my bloop. How is my bloop? My bloop's good.
Good, thanks. Good. Great comedy from Jim and Tomek.
We were talking with one of our bosses, and he kept talking about how this show was funny, and I was like, I don't think this show's that funny.
Exactly. I had... One of my friends was like, I don't know if people have heard it, but they add... that we ran on the other BPN shows. And one of my friends was like, it was so good. I just loved it. I was like, what did you listen to? It was abysmal. Abominable embarrassment.
I'm glad people like us.
How sad is that? I'm glad people like... I am also glad. Anyway.
Candy, opera, musical, operetta, who knows?
Genuinely, who knows? Not me.
Oh, boy,
Well, now that we're super clear about what Candide is.
Right. And now that we've talked about how shitty the story is, do you want to talk about the story?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do it. I mean, right.
It's got heart.
You gotta have heart. Musical theater reference.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
But
damn
like
Yankee. That's can we talk about that instead?
That's the Venn diagram I want about like how much time we spend talking about other shows on episodes that are supposed to be about a particular show.
Exactly. I think, do you know what though? I think with Candide, I think one of the reasons why in this one in particular we're diverging is because it's so philosophical.
Yes.
As in the core piece, the original text is philosophical in nature.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're talking about something that is literally an idea, you then interpret it through other means because it's easier.
Right. And it's hard to give that sort of thing a concrete physicality, you know?
Totally.
To root it in a world or a person or a place or a story.
Absolutely. And a story, that's exactly it, because testament to what we've just spoken about for an hour, it's really hard to say, to talk about the story of Candide, the opera musical.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of different stories, you know? There's one, there's like a plot, but there's many different stories.
Right. Yeah. And they're and all towards the goal. Like, what would you say? Because if this is philosophical, right,
mm-hmm.
then at the end, at the third midnight, Voltaire's going to come out and, you know, say his moral for the story.
Right.
Like, what is the moral of Candide?
Well, it's funny because I've seen so many different interpretations.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. Like, so what I'm going to say just now, I don't really like philosophy. Right? I don't like it. Mm. The reason why, and I don't know much about it. Well, no, I don't know much about it. I've never studied it.
You've paired the two worst sentences together you possibly can for the internet.
I don't like something and I don't know anything about it. Absolutely. But I still can have opinions on it, right?
Of course. That's all we do on this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate that I'm ignorant, right? And I've had many discussions with people who are really passionate about philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully appreciate their passion. But it's not for me because I find it really inhibiting. I think, you know, I've spoken to people and met people in my life who really, really buy into, you know, Nietzsche mm-hmm. or Marxism. And they really live their life by this very strict code.
Yeah.
And this set of rules, this philosophy. Which is really, it's an ideology.
Yeah.
And when you say things to them, it's like, well, no, because Nietzsche said this.
Right.
And I'm like, but I'm sure I could find you somewhere in the Rolodex. Well, this person said this, mm-hmm. and that's different. Who's correct? You like Nietzsche, so you're going to say Nietzsche. But I'm going to say Rousseau was correct.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to say Voltaire was correct.
Yeah.
You know? It's too silly.
Yeah.
Do you
is it the finality of it? The like, this is the worldview, draw a circle around it, we're done.
Totally. Because I've had people be like, oh, so you're X because I've said something.
Right.
And I'm like, no, I don't have any idea what you're talking about because I've never read this.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone else have had the same thoughts as I have.
Yeah.
But I've had those thoughts. Those are my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't influenced by Nietzsche or whoever, like
right.
nihilism or I don't know. Like I came up with that myself, and I'm proud of that because mm-hmm. that was a little moment of like, ah, oh, light bulb.
Yeah.
I'm not then going to be like, okay, who's found this light bulb before me? Oh, okay, so this is what my next six light bulbs should look like.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I like the melting pot. I like going on journeys, and I like thinking yeah. about different things and interpreting yeah. and making opinions up on them.
Well, wouldn't you? In some versions of Candide, the musical, we have Pangloss, and then we have oh god, the old man in the cave. He's got a name, Nega Pangloss.
The Spanish one
is he? There is a foil to Pangloss who, in some versions, they meet. He sings words, words, words. Martin.
Oh, on the boat.
On the boat, sometimes on the boat,
section.
But in other versions, you know, he sings like the worst of all possible worlds. There is this character who is, you know, we get, it's chicken and egg, and I'm not sure, and I'm sure I could look it up, but I'm not. But like the idea of a Panglossian view of life, that everything will be good. And then there is this foil to that, that everything is terrible, right? And if you start expanding and looking on Candide, there are, they expand upon, you know, 10 or 11 different philosophical views of life. You know, is it this religion or that religion? Is it a view and everything's for the best? Is it a view and everything's for the worst? Is it a view and so many things are happening that is too busy? Is it a view that so few things are happening that I am so bored with life? The conclusion they end up on is like, whatever, we'll build a house, we'll tend our garden and do what we can. And so, like, I would say Candide is almost a rejection of your view, or what, like, I think you and Candide at the end of the show would agree.
I would agree with your agreement. yeah, because, I mean, like, so Voltaire wrote it in response to the I think it was Leibniz, who had this idea of, like, optimism full stop.
Yeah.
Best of all possible worlds, everything's for the best, great. And, you know, that was quite deeply steeped in religion, that there was a greater power,
right,
and everything had meaning,
yeah,
because of that. And that is Pangloss, you know, that is exactly who that is,
right?
And yeah, Candide goes on this journey and learns that, well, actually, maybe that isn't the right thing,
right,
and gets to this stage at the end where he's like, okay, it's this.
Yeah.
But then, I don't know, even then people just can't accept that.
Yeah.
Because I've seen, like, pages upon pages of debates of people being like, well, the ending is very this person, or the ending is very this philosopher.
Right. Well, and even the differences between how the ending is interpreted, whether it is this hopeful, great, where flowers sprout out of the stage, or this terrible, right, backed by, you know, the nuclear wasteland that humanity has wrought upon the earth.
Right, exactly. And I think, like, for me, right, my interpretation of it, because that's all I have. I don't have my books and philosophy to look through and relate things to.
Yeah.
My interpretation of it is that it's like, it all comes down to that line of, like, we do the best we know.
Yeah.
Right? That's literally all we can do ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Genuinely, that is the baseline. And I think when you accept that, it's all good, mate. Do
yeah.
you know what I mean? Like, genuinely, because it's like, okay, are you doing the best you can?
Right.
Good.
Yeah. Well, and that, I mean, that is what, if you, as two-dimensional as these characters are, that is, you know, Candide's modus operandi throughout the whole thing. You know, every time he accidentally murders someone or makes a choice, as if you can even call them choices when he makes them, it's always like, well, this seems like the best choice we could make in this situation.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it bites him in the ass. But, like, that is, and then he learns from that. It's like, still, you wanted, and, like, that is different from optimism. Like, that is, you know, that to me is the rub of the thing. It's not,
it's just kind of like, accept it. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
But then people would say, oh, that's nihilistic. And I'm like, it's not.
Right.
Because I don't understand what that is. So it's not that. Do you know what I mean? Because actually there's like 20 other influences going on that have got me to that decision.
Mm-hmm.
It is not one worldview.
Right.
And it frustrates me. it really frustrates me.
Yeah.
Well,
that's, I mean, I think that's one of the poisons of pieces like this, of musical theater. On the page, Candide seems very simplistic, right? And you can leave it with a very simplistic view of the moral that you learned.
Yeah.
You know,
happy ending.
Happy ending, but because we accept the middle ground. Things aren't for the best, but they're also not for the worst.
Yeah.
And like that interpretation isn't wrong. But,
well, no interpretation is wrong.
Yeah, right, because there's a thousand of them.
Exactly.
But like that is the question of, like, does this story tell itself in the best way? And is that Bernstein's problem or Voltaire's problem? Like,
Well, I think at the time Voltaire wrote the best story he could, absolutely, and I think it worked.
He wrote the Candide version of the story. He did the best he knew.
He Candided the heck out of that. But interestingly enough, I think in this day and age, Candide isn't the right story to tell.
Yeah,
to
why
tell
not?
That, to illustrate that point. Because it's, I think it's really... I'm going to get hit in the face.
That's fine.
I think it's a bit up its own arse.
That I agree with. Yes.
And I think people... I think people really buy into that. I'm not saying that it isn't steeped in intellectualism and it isn't steeped in interpretation. Like, there is... It is... The pamphlet that was written however many hundred years ago was very good because look at the years that have passed and look at us still now trying to interpret it,
right?
Still trying to work out what it's saying,
right?
And I think, I'm not saying I don't think it's frivolous, I think it does have meaning, but I think for theater, for musical theater, I don't have any interest in learning anything from it. I think I get the ending, and I like the ending, and I like that point of being like, here's an idea.
Right.
I didn't need the past 2 hours.
Do you think it's because it sets itself up as a morality tale?
No.
Okay.
And because I'm going to cite two things here.
Excellent.
Two pieces of musical theater. Remember that? I'm going to cite Pippin and I'm going to cite Godspell. Sorry, we're talking about Pippin again. But weirdly, both by Schwartz.
Yeah.
Funny. After watching Candide, all I wanted to do was listen to Godspell.
Interesting.
Because I wasn't angered by it. To me, right, Godspell and Pippin are both equally as interpretable pieces of theatre as Candide.
Yeah.
And again, there'll be people out there that will think I am trash talking this because this is a, you know, it's just Voltaire, like, it's a historical piece of fiction. Absolutely.
Right.
But to be honest, I get more from watching Pippin and I get more from watching Godspell than I do from watching Candide because it's more relatable. To me, again, this is all just opinion. It's more relatable.
Yeah.
It's done in a more cohesive fashion.
Sure.
Like, no one's been like, how the hell do we tell Pippin? Pippin is a story that has been revived very successfully and not much changed other than its interpretation.
It's a good, Pippin especially is a good parallel to a lot of Candide stuff because it is, you know, episodic.
Same story,
You know, it takes place long ago.
Absolutely.
Distinct ties to its history that they tell you enough about but also don't burden you with trying to understand. You know, you don't need to know who Charlemagne was to understand Pippin.
Right. I mean, and this is like a literary thing here of, I think it's like picaresque or Bildungsroman. I've seen both these words thrown around. Of like a coming of age, a learning, often by like a male archetype. And, you know, for Pippin, and actually kind of Godspell, because it's just a different person. And I kind of almost want to talk about that in a bit as well. But I don't know, you can go along on the ride with him and you're not throwing all of this opulence and all of this grandeur that comes with Bernstein's Candide.
Yeah.
You're not confused, really.
Right.
You might be a bit like, this is weird.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I still wonder, because like Pippin is less set up to be a morality tale in its existence than Candide is. Because Candide is written, you know, like... It starts off as a lesson, right? Let me teach you this thing, and then in many versions ends with any questions, which is a joke, but still drives it home. Whereas Pippin, there's a story there. Sounds stupid to say it out loud, but like you can enjoy just the story of Pippin and not come away with it, and you don't need to come away with it with a moral, and still have enjoyed the piece. I don't think anyone's like, oh man, the beautiful story of Candide. Like, Cunegonde and Candide are such, you know, they're the Romeo and Juliet. They're like, I was so excited for them to... No, it's, you know, it's clownish how vapid their relationship is, right? Even through to the end when they decide they're going to settle down together and, you know, get married, right? You don't really...
Yeah, it still means nothing.
You don't really care about the romance between them, right?
Right.
Which is not true of Pippin, right? You care about Pippin. Like, I don't know what I'm getting
at. But what I would say is, like, surely that's better when you're watching theater.
Right. I like,
because I'm not reading a pamphlet on philosophy.
Right.
I'm not reading a pamphleted response to a philosopher's ideals.
Right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm going into a house and I'm watching theatre.
Right.
And I'm not saying theatre can't have moral. Obviously not. If you know anything about me, that is literally my thing.
Right. But it does.
You are there to experience a story.
Right.
And kind of what I've been saying with Candide is like, I don't know if the story is there.
Right. It does. This is an oversimplification, but because of the way Voltaire has written Candide, the musical adaptation of Candide is kind of more comparable if there was like, you know, the Communist Manifesto, the musical. Right.
Oh my God. Marx.
Right. Yeah. Marx. Exclamation point.
Exactly.
But you know what I mean? Like, because its source material is so seeped in some underlying, you know, political motive.
Moralism. I mean, yeah.
It is then harder to make the story worthwhile or interesting.
Right. So there you go. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the thing, is like, that's my issue.
Right.
Because,
like, the problem is Bernstein wrote such great songs for it. Like, I think that's the problem with Candide.
Absolutely.
Is the music is so infectious.
But Bernstein's songs, outside of Make Our Garden Grow,
yeah,
don't hugely tell the story that Voltaire is talking about. Do you know what I mean? For the most part, like, they talk about other things.
Yeah, the ones that do are those ones that I said earlier that are set in stone in the order, right?
Yeah.
Best of All Possible Worlds, Auto da Fe, Glitter and Be Gay, and then Make Our Garden Grow.
And I don't know. I'm just like,
right. Well, and that's
I'd rather watch Pippin.
It all like circles around the same point about like musical or operetta or like the problems with adaptation. That like in musical theater, the idea is the songs further the story and the character development, but you're adapting from a piece where those elements are secondary to some other primary element, the satirical, philosophical commentary that Voltaire is trying to make. And so then you get like an incompatibility between those two genres that then result in the confusion of this thing for, you know, half a century.
For sure. But then I don't know, because I'm thinking like, I was like, okay, I need to think of like, give me a like concept, the musical, right? And there's so many, because like,
you know,
look at Company.
You know what a fair one is, and you might not have listened to this one because it's not great, but there is, have you heard of The Adding Machine?
Yeah, I love The Adding Machine.
You, okay, all right.
Okay, I love The Adding Machine because it's wackadoo.
Sure, right.
I think if I saw a production of it, I would be bored.
Yeah, well, and it was a play first that was equally as wackadoo. That is a philosophical commentary on what, 1920s Americana?
Kind of. Zeitgeist.
Yeah, you know, like a weird expressionistic piece. If you know nothing about The Adding Machine, you should look it up, the play or the musical.
You'll love the opening.
It's a work,
it will get weird.
A workplace murder drama.
Potentially.
Yeah. But it's super expressionist, but has a philosophical edge to it, right?
But it absolutely does, yeah.
And I think leans into that more so in a way that lets you know that, like, these characters are not people. They're characters, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas Candide treads that line in the other direction. Like, no, Candide is a boy. He is a human boy, right?
Yeah.
With human feelings. Except as you watch more of him, he's got, like, three motivational words and the, you know, slot machine spins in his head and it lands on one of them each scene.
I think maybe that is it. Maybe it's the character. Maybe it is the characters. Maybe I'm like, who are you? Why have you been 12 people already? Why have you died 3 times? Like, I have no investment in you.
Right.
And it kind of goes beyond
Werfendung's
effect. It goes beyond that alienation idea.
Yeah.
Because they are trying to be characters.
Right. Well, I think that is one of the things that the Zimmerman production did do that I very much enjoyed was that Candide, they tried very hard not to make him 2-dimensional. He wasn't that chipper, like, oh, I am a, you know, 40-year-old tenor playing a tiny boy. Like, he was cast younger, which I would like more appropriately aged.
Yeah.
You know, they'd cast someone who was a better actor than I think a lot of the opera singers who they cast in this role. But then you could see him, you know, run into these struggles every time he met someone with a new philosophy. Like, oh, that's the way the world should be? Oh, right, okay. But is that... And, you know, there's not a lot of time to watch him have those moments. So,
yeah,
you know, perhaps I am adding my own feeling on top of it a little more. But then when he does finally make the decision at the end, like, well, I guess we'll just build a house, you know, as opposed to like, we'll just build a house, I guess, right?
Yeah.
As so many of these other productions do. Like, I think that's what I want in my Candide.
I would agree, because to me, I'm like, well, that sounds like Pippin.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Here's a kid who struggle.
Yeah.
And then makes a decision and it's all taken away from it. Do you know what I mean? Like, but he's still happy with his decision. Like, that, to me, is... That sounds like that. But also, you're still having to sit through a lot of guff.
Right, to get there. Yeah. In a way that doesn't really pay off.
No.
Like, you could cut, you don't need to encounter this one particular philosophy for Candide to have, you know, reach his conclusion at the very, very end.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, I kind of appreciate it.
Yeah.
But I don't really have this feeling with a lot of musicals.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing, I think.
Yeah, sure. Especially because we do a musical theater podcast.
Right, exactly. But as in, like, I'm often like, do you know what? Here's its merit. Here's
yeah,
I love it.
That's true.
But I'm reluctant with Candide.
Yeah.
Because of its pedigree,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I'm like, this should be better by now.
Yeah. I read this line in one of the many theses, so I can't, and I didn't cite it, so I'm doing a bad job here, but I thought this was very apt. Someone wrote, "The dramatic irony is that Candide, the musical, is a journey and not a destination, much like the show itself."
Yep.
And I think that is... speaks volumes.
Exactly. No, but you're it's totally right, because there are people that would have read Voltaire's pamphlet and disagreed with it wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
And there are people that will go and see Candide and they will disagree with it wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
That's fine. Yeah. That's theater.
If that's, you know, that means it is, you know, perhaps for its faults, still doing its job.
Absolutely.
And the music is gorgeous.
The music's really good. We've not said that once. The music's amazing.
There's a I disappointed a lot of people. I don't think you've seen it yet. In a moment of insomnia, I published...
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I published a video on Musical Theater MASH, long awaited, that people got very excited about. And it's really just a cut up of the finale of Candide and Animal Crossing, and I still find it very funny.
Do you know what's interesting though? Huh. Deeply emotional talk.
Surprisingly so. Like, I started it as a joke, and I was getting into it. And I was like, "This is really moving."
Exactly. Because I don't know whether Tommy, whether it's just because of all of the shenanigans going on, at the moment. But I watched that, and I was just really like, you know, watching your little guy make his garden. I was like, that's beautiful. And you know what, it's just so interesting because obviously at the moment there are a lot of people.
Right, hold on, I can hear an ice cream truck. Is that you?
Yeah, I know that's gonna happen a lot.
Okay.
So we'll just brush through it.
Okay.
Optimism. Ice cream. But no, I think it, yeah, all over the world right now people are playing Animal Crossing and making these little gardens,
right,
and kind of taking a step back and looked at what they've got and at the moment are doing the best they know.
Yeah.
And I think that weirdly links up really nicely with Candide.
Yeah.
The finale of Candide.
Absolutely.
Because that's that idea of like it's taking the time to simplify.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I've had lots of conversations with people where they're saying that, do you know what, I've realized a lot, more so than I ever have, because I've stopped.
Yeah, yeah. When there, I was on a socially distanced walk around the block the other day, and someone had written on the sidewalk, adversity makes a man confront himself.
Mm.
And there is, you know, whether it's in Candide or in, you know, this life-changing world we're living in right now, but there is something about, like, insurmountable obstacle and confrontation with like the constructed human world that we live in, and mm-hmm. once pieces of it start getting slashed away, it really, really makes you confront what you have control over and what brings you joy.
Exactly. There it is. There it is. It's what brings you joy.
Yeah.
It's what are you going to do today that's just going to make you happy?
Yeah.
You're now given permission to do that.
Yeah.
I've been taking a lot of solace in that idea, and it's really like I feel good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is a funny thing to say at the moment, but I feel really good because I've thought about this a lot.
Yeah.
And I have really taken the time to look at myself
mm-hmm.
and be like, hang on.
Yeah.
Why was I stressed?
Yeah. Well, and it's, I think one of the crazy things is people have introspective life-changing moments all the time, right? But individually. And
exactly.
Right? That now we're all doing it. You know, now
well,
we're,
one.
Uh-huh. we're all playing Animal Crossing at once.
Exactly. We're all playing Animal Crossing at once, and we can talk to people about Animal Crossing.
Right. You know, metaphorically and actually.
Exactly. You know, and people will get it.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, mean that not as a joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is interesting. It is interesting that, you know, accidentally Candide has kind of landed on...
Our predictions really do
start
to get a bit scary.
Right, exactly. During these challenging times. And I don't mean to, you know, I'm sure neither of us mean to be flippant about the
not at all
the current
not
global
at all
pandemic.
Because I do take it very seriously.
Oh yeah.
And I think, you know, at the end of the day, we've still got that garden to tend to.
Right.
So let's just get in about it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's
yeah.
the thing is you're like, well, okay, how are you going to do that?
Well, we'll do the best we know. You know,
we do the best we know.
It is very apt for all of its craziness.
Yeah. Thank you, Leonard Bernstein. Well, Tommy, we made it through our journey.
54 years later or whatever.
I'm exhausted.
It feels like we've traversed an ocean and our boat has sunk.
I think I got syphilis, but then I got cured of it, and then I was stabbed, and then I came back to life.
And then
anyway.
A statue fell on me.
Yeah, that was a shame.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But there's a sheep just beside me, so I'm happy.
We didn't even talk about the animals.
We didn't talk about the sheep.
Those damn sheep, they don't make any sense. I always forget that they're there, and then the sheep show up again. I'm like, oh, yeah, this damn part.
But weirdly again, do you know another show where there's weird sheep? Godspell. Just saying. Anyway, what's next?
I got a quiz question for you.
Hit me.
It's not a question, but I'm going to say it with an upward inflection, so it sounds like one.
Great.
Sammy Davis Jr. was originally slated to originate this role in its pre-musical incarnation. Who knows if the show would have been such a runaway success if it were more Rat Pack in style?
Who knows?
If you want to get in touch with us, the show Twitter is Jim and Tomic, or join us in the Reddit discussion. Links are in the show notes right now in your podcatcher or at jimandtomic.com.
Yes, and while you are there, you can check out our Patreon page if you would like to financially support the show. We want to give a big, big love to all of our current patrons who, even in these times, are still supporting us. And we love you for that. But if you want, you can just go over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review there, because they're great.
And most of all, it just helps that you listen. You know, tell your friends. Everyone's looking for something to do right now. If you need a good backlog of stuff, we got a huge one. It's a great time to jump in.
We've got almost 80 episodes for you, my friend.
Look at us. You know, and thanks for listening. Be safe out there.
Yep. I hear the ice cream van.
Yeah, Jimmy's got new neighbors. He's going to go, do they throw? How does that even work? Do they throw the ice cream at you?
How can you socially distance ice cream? I know, exactly. I think it's a whole illegal affair. I don't approve, but hey. So yeah, that's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. And cheers.
Cheers.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Thank you, Leonard Bernstein. You're welcome.
He's right behind you, Jimmy. Quick! He's not 6 feet away. Run!
Excuse me. I'm taking this seriously. Thank you.